The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2007 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown Los Angeles as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit www.aloudla.org. It's a great honor for Aloud to be able to present Edna O'Brien here at the Los Angeles Public Library. In terms of our format tonight, Edna O'Brien will be reading from her new work, and then she will be joined in conversation by writer Vanessa Place. Vanessa is the author of Dies, A Sentence, a 50,000 one-sentence novel, which poet Susan McCabe describes as humbling and beyond paraphrase, both mythic and contemporary. And the American Book Review calls a delightful tour de force of a hopelessly grim predicament. Vanessa is a criminal appellate attorney and the co-founder of Le Figue Press, publisher of the Trenchart series of experimental literature. After their conversation, Edna O'Brien and Vanessa will take some questions from the audience. We'll have a microphone circulating. Please bear in mind that we won't have time for all of your questions. And afterwards, Edna O'Brien and Vanessa will be signing their books in the lobby, courtesy of the library store. To introduce Ms. O'Brien tonight is her good friend, Angelica Houston. Angelica Houston is an Academy Award-winning actress and critically acclaimed director. Raised in Ireland, aha, the connection, Houston is part of the third generation of a renowned cinematic legacy that began with her grandfather Walter and her father John. In 1985, Ms. Houston earned an Oscar for her performance in Pritzi's Honor, making her the first third-generation Academy winner in history. She made her directorial debut in 1996 with her unflinching adaptation of Dorothy Allison's best-selling memoir, Bastard Out of Carolina, and she was nominated for a Directors Guild of America Award and an Emmy for her work. She's involved in many philanthropic projects. I won't name them all, but among them, and certainly not the least of them, is her wonderful friendship with the Los Angeles Public Library and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. She's been a great friend, and we're deeply grateful. Please welcome Angelica Houston.
Thank you so much for that extensive introduction. It makes me sound very old. Good evening and welcome. It's an honor for me to introduce Edna O'Brien to you tonight. She's one of Ireland's, indeed the world's greatest writers. I've known Edna since I was 12 years old, and that is a long time. She astonishes me. She's one of the most vulnerable people and one of the strongest people I know. I'm astonished by her work. She was born in Tuamgraney, County Clare, a small county village in the west of Ireland. I'm trying to do this without my glasses. In her introduction to her collection, Seven Novels and Other Short Stories, in 1978, O'Brien describes her childhood as characterized by religious indoctrination at every level. Everything, including the smallest daily act, was the subject of scrutiny and self-policing. Even swallowing seemed to be a sin, O'Brien recalls. All these sins produced a furtive desire, she writes, a wild and over-fertile fantasy life. So I railed against my religion as I grew up. I do not know why I railed against it, because to tell the truth, I wanted to be in God's good books. After finishing convent school in 1946, O'Brien was sent to Dublin, where she worked in a chemist shop during the day and studied at night at the Pharmaceutical College of Ireland, graduating in 1950. Pharmacy's loss was literature's gain. O'Brien bought her first book in Dublin, a copy of T.S. Eliot's Introducing James Joyce. These selections of the writing of Joyce inspired her. Encouraged by the editor of a Dublin magazine, She made her writing debut in the form of small contributions to the Irish press in 1948. 12 years later, she published her first book, The Country Girls. It was banned in Ireland, considered a smear on Irish womanhood. Copies of the book were burned in O'Brien's local parish. She moved to London, where she's lived for many years, joining the ranks of Irish writers like James Joyce and Samuel Beckett, who spent their lives in self-imposed exile. In an interview, O'Brien commented, "It's important when writing to feel free, answerable to no one. The minute you feel you're answerable, you're throttled. Writing makes you lonely because you have to exile yourself. But deeper than that is an inborn native loneliness, a spiritual void that words, for some reason, help fill." She added, "I would say that every writer I've ever admired, like Faulkner, whom I love, and Joyce, or Emily Bronte, Sylvia Plath, Chekhov, Beckett, regardless of their particular daily history, has a loneliness and a depth of feeling that cannot be corresponded to, and that's why they write." The Light of Evening, which she will discuss tonight, is her 20th work of fiction. It is a novel of dreams and attachments, lamentations and betrayals. At its core is the realization that the bond between mother and child is unbreakable, stronger even in death. And I just wanted to read a little piece from the Los Angeles Times the other day, and I think they really got it right, about Edna. "Her fiction remains so vital and engaged, so contemptuous of piety and convention, so hostile to sentiment, and so willing to risk real feelings, that it sometimes seems as if the author must have sprung from one of those islands of eternal youth and beauty with which Irish mythology dotted the seas west of her native County Clare. But because she did not, we have now a shelf full of novels and story collections that constitute one of the scant handful of careers in English-speaking letters that unquestionably deserves to be called great." Well, here she is, the timeless one. And as Nuala O'Fallon said, insight has become prophecy. The beautiful Edna O'Brien.
Well, after that, Angelica, what can I do? I've heard about this library, and I never thought I would be invited here. But I am, and I'm on a slightly wayward stool. But I'll sort that out. The Light of Evening, I'm going to read a little bit from it, and then Vanessa is going to ask me cogent questions, and then we'll have other questions. "There is a photograph of my mother as a young woman in a white dress, standing by her mother, who is seated out of doors on a kitchen chair in front of a plantation of evergreen trees. Her mother is staring with a grave expression, her gnarled fingers clasped as in prayer. Despite the virgin marvel of the white dress and the obligingness of her stance, my mother has heard the mating calls of the world beyond and has seen a picture of a white ship far out at sea. The photograph would have been taken of a Sunday and for a special reason, perhaps on account of the daughter's looming departure. A stillness reigns. One can feel the sultriness, the sun beating down on the tops of the drowsing trees and over the nondescript fields and on to the bluish swathe of a mountain. Later, as the day cools and they have gone in, the cry of the corncrake will carry across those same fields and over the lake to the blue-hazed mountain, such a lonely evening sound to it, like the lonely evening sound of the mothers saying, It is not our fault that we weep so. It is nature's fault that makes us first full, then empty. Such is the wrath of the mothers. Such is the cry of the mothers. Such is the lamentation of the mothers. On and on until the last day, the last bluish tinge, the pismires, the gloaming, and the dying dust. And the mother's name is Dilly, and this is the morning, first chapter of the book, the morning she's leaving her house. "Will you pipe down out of that, Dilly," says I said. "Will you pipe down out of that, Dilly," says she said. "Demon of a crow out there before daylight, cawing and croaking, rummaging in the palm tree that is not a palm tree, but for some reason misnamed so. Queer bird, all by herself, neither chick nor child, with her omening and her conundruming." It gives Dilly the shivers, it does. "And she's storing her precious little bits and pieces for safety's sake, wrapping the cut glasses in case her husband Cornelius is mad enough to use them or lay one down before Crossy the workman, who'd fling it on a hedge or a headland as if it were a billy can. Her little treasures, each item reminding her of someone or of something. The bone china with the flowers that Eleonora loved, and as a child would sit in front of the china cabinet, rhapsodizing over the sprigs of roses and forget-me-nots, painted with such lifelikeness on the biscuit barrel and the two-tiered cake plate. That last jug, a souvenir of the walk in the vast cemetery in Brooklyn in the 12th month with the tall bearded man, searching the tombstones and the flat slabs for the names of the Irish-born and coming upon the grave of a Matilda, the widow of Wolfe Tone, and pausing to pay tribute to her. Yes, she is asking her possessions to keep watch over the house, to mind Rasheen, asking her plates with pictures of pears and pomegranates, asking the milk-white china cups with their beautiful rims of gold dimmed here and there from the graze of lips, a few cracked where thoughtless visitors had flung them down, that raver for once, who ate enough for four men, raving on about Mora Rua, whoever Mora Rua was, some lore that Eleonora was versed in. Books and mythologies, her daughter's whole life, putting her on the wrong track from the outset. The suitcase is already down in the hall, covered with a leather strap, because of one of the brass catches being slack. And lucky it is that Cornelius had to go miles away for the mare to be covered. She wants no tears, no snivelling. Amazing that he got softer over the years, particularly in the last 9 months, and she laid low with the shingles, often walking in her sleep, anything to quell the pain, found by him out at the water tank, splashing water all over herself to ease the ire. "What did I do wrong? What did I do wrong?" he kept asking, putting his cap on and off as he loitered. "Nothing. You did nothing wrong," she answered, thereby cancelling the tribulation of the years. She goes to the hospital in Dublin, meets her nemesis in the form of a sturdy nurse with grey lisle stockings and a grey lisle heart, who insists that she take sleeping pills. And she's a woman who has never wanted to have any drug of any kind, lest she lose her balance and her staunchly adherent secrets. However, she's made to take the tablets. And as in childbirth, the floodgates of her mind, in childbirth it was her body, but now her mind opens things she had never intended to reveal. And indeed, the tall bearded man from the time in Brooklyn so long before. I am, and feel for the bell, Dilly. It's somewhere, find it. Nurse, she can't hear me. They're not listening. Is this how I die? Is this how one dies? No one to give me the last sacrament. All alone, and didn't I rock the cradle like many another mother? Oh God, I am slipping. Well, if it isn't himself that's in it, If it isn't Gabriel, eyes the softest brown, the brown of the bulrushes. The lake reeds never boast a bulrush, but the bog reeds do. Cottony before they don their stout brown truncheons. Men are queer fish, hard and soft. Both, all pie when they want you, so sweet and whispery sweeter than a woman, they're not distant. Wild iris is beyond in that field, they're kind of swaying, hard to beat them. The upper part of your face is familiar, and so is your good new navy suit, you scamp you. Nothing is forgotten. Up to the time he was 7, St. Columbkill was a very unruly boy. Things miscarry, letters, gifts. The waistcoat I was making for you that black Christmas, I posted it to Wisconsin, to the wilds, where you sawed trees all day long, from dawn till dusk, you and a Finn, lost 2 of your fingers there. The pressed jasmine and aster that you stole in the municipal park that Sunday in Brooklyn, I have had it framed. A simple dark green frame on a bed of white silk ruching, you might have written. Every bit of your daily life interests me. I wrote this day fortnight. It was returned, tampered with. Are you by any chance dead? A post office mistress has a speciality for opening other people's letters. Not easy for me making time to write. I have a man very hard on socks, and workmen need 3 meals a day with jugs of tea and bread in between. My darling, you will always have a message from me. If only a postcard, when I cannot make time for a letter, I would know if you were dead. Perhaps you're on your way here. Be sure to bring a candle, a Christmas candle. We need a bit of light to shed on things. So many misunderstandings. I was going across to you. You were coming across to me. But I was motioned back and told to sit down and wait, and that you would be with me 7 years from this day. If you would get yourself photographed, front face and silhouette, send it to me, and I will send postal order by return. Sometimes a well-dressed lady on horseback rides past the window at night with leaflets to distribute. Things on her mind, I reckon. Walk right round the house when you come, in case of spying, and then tap on the window a good smart rap and I'll sit up. We could go to the boathouse in Googie Park, a boat half rotten, but we'll be safe. Safe enough off there on that empty island with no one to split us asunder. Write to me, write to me. I'm weary, weary of asking. I am weary, weary of the pen. And strangely enough, although she was in real life and in fiction, the mother was very disapproving and repudiating of the written word, but was a great letter writer, and here is a sample of one of her letters. The mayor ran last week, came only 3rd, £30 for us against 300 for 1st. The galling part is she can win if she likes, but she's temperamental. There were 20 in the race and 12 near winners. She can be last and out of the blue pass them by, if she feels like it. Horses are the ruination of everyone. Your father has a craze for them, but then we all do crazy things. You work too hard, it will get to your nerves in the end. I haven't got the same energy, but didn't I do my bit for ye, and maybe God will give me a few more years. Sad to say, years and months seem all one now, the same pattern. Eat, feed the animals, sit by the fire at night and brood. The coat you sent I wear all the time. I hate to put on anything else. I had an old Persian lamb collar from a black coat of years back stitched onto it, and people rave over it. The horse did not run well yesterday. When one sees that they are losing and losing and losing, it's time to say enough. But I don't offer a word, it would lead to civil war. The weather the past week, bitter cold. I went all day with my old coat on and a headscarf. But it's not so bad if we don't get the snows. I don't think I could do a slimming fast the way you do. Even a bit of dry bread would suffice. I barely eat cake now. The one I'm sending you, make a hole on the top with a knitting needle and pour a glass of whiskey into it to keep it moist. Last week I drew I don't know how many buckets of water and spray the whole avenue to kill the weeds. It's sad if things get neglected, but I should have enough sense not to bother. Yet, when you spend your life in a place, you like to see it as spick as can be. Since I came back from you and from London, I haven't been out only to Mass and 3 funerals. That restaurant with the fortunes in the cookies was just out of this world. And the spice in the Moroccan lamb, so individual. The new shoes you got me will have a rest for a long time. I like little bits of news. Is the black lace frock you wore that evening an antique? I hope you get to come soon. I sent you yesterday 18 large doilies, 7 small ones and 4 centerpieces. I am praying you will make use of them. If not, you can give them to someone. Love from, undying love from your mother, Dilly. And there were, which you'll be pleased to know, this is not the Mahabharata, I won't be reading you, hundreds of such letters. And this is the voice of Eleonora, the daughter. It's a journal she keeps, which indeed is not in the form of a letter that she intends to send, but journals like letters and diaries, and like all secret things, they get read by someone, very often the wrong one. So this is her account of a glimpse of her life, separate from her mother, or trying to be separate. Because it's always like that. There are no real separations, no more than there are any total connections. The woman doctor I consulted was less of a wall than the 2 ponderous gentlemen. Bertha was her name. Her eyes soft and dark as sloes. And the fact that she was Eastern held out even greater promise. I thought that she, or maybe another, could reach in and pull out all the tribulation and the mountainous bile in me. These thoughts often become fanciful, and I picture different methods, many surgical. Then recalled my mother putting wire down the throttles of young chickens to cure them of their pip. She would cure me of my pip. I would arrive early and walk up and down her wide, wind-swept street. I say wind-swept because there was always building work and hence rubbish and grit flying about. They were white stucco houses, several stories high, with basements, one of which was her consulting room, number 48. I would keep my eyes on her door. It was a black door with a knocker that jammed, and wait for the patient preceding me to be helped out. She was a younger woman in a wheelchair, and a chauffeur came to collect her just minutes before she was due out, then carry her up the steps. There was something so poignant about this young woman being carried up those steps and making sure always to smile. After me each week was a man, tall, owl-like, with owlish eyes and metallic grey hair, shoulder length. I reckoned it was a wig. One day the owl man was there ahead of me, and to my consternation, as soon as the chauffeur left, Owlman followed and stationed himself in the doorway. He spoke to Bertha, and in those moments I became frantic at the prospect of losing my precious appointment. Bertha was nodding, listening. Obviously he was giving her a cock and a bull story about having to catch a train or an aeroplane, and she was falling for it. She saw me, saw my importuning, and presently he was coming back up the steps, muttering and galled. Months later, I did something extreme. I rang Bertha up one evening, invited her over, implying that it was important. She came, muffled up. What a thrill it was! What a clandestine thrill it was to see her, to watch her, remove her garments and throw them off one by one, her scarf, her hat, her coat, and her black kid gloves. She had crossed from the land of wide streets to the narrow streets where I live. She was glowing. The fur collar around her throat brought to my mind a painting Rubens did of his second wife, who, though clad in white ermine, seemed stark naked. She had taken trouble with her makeup, coal under her eyes, and the amethyst choker that she wore seemed to deepen the dark pools of her being. We ate and drank and lolled, sat on big cushions, she so plump and languorous and confiding, telling tales of a childhood in Alexandria, a rocking horse with jade stones for eyes, orchards of pomegranates that, when ripe, she and her sister would trample on, visiting uncles, all of whom she knew, even then, had a thing for her. And she knew even then just how much rain to give them. Dancing in the evening in their drawing rooms, parents and uncles and guests and cousins and children, dancing to an orchestra that had been summoned from the city. The fact that I could not dance was of no consequence to Bertha. She said I would find freedom in it, and maybe even some pleasure. There we were, dancing, my doctor and me, her womanly arm soft but firm as junket, the musk smell of her perfume, dancing as though in the fields of youth, the steps as wild and as fluid as she decreed them, in and out of the various downstairs rooms, rooms that had been crying out for a bit of life, and thence into the garden, regardless of the season, where, in the aftermath of a shower of rain, the air was so damp and so refreshing. Soon as she got her breath back, she broached it, but most tentatively. I had said on the phone that her coming to see me was important. How could I tell her that it was, but now that it was not? How could I tell her that for 28 years since I first read it as a young wife, I had clung to the fable of the Stefan Wolf, believing that his redemption would also become mine? I had thought and thought of Harry Haller as he chanced on the black sheen of the wet asphalt in an unfamiliar quarter of the old town, chanced upon the fallen lettering that, when pieced together, read, "Magic Theatre, Magic Theatre for Madmen Only." Going inside, he encountered Hermione, the mysterious hermaphrodite, who taught him the tango and many of life's sweet poisons. But sitting there with Bertha, I knew that Harry Haller's magic theatre was not our theatre, my mother's and mine. No more than Prue's hawthorns, in all their pink and tender effulgence, could be our hawthorns, my mother's and mine. Our hawthorns and ourselves belonging off back there in that sacral and saturate place, and just as dearly as I had longed for Bertha to come, I now longed for her to be gone, so that I could allow in the wolf of loneliness at last. And that's it for now. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think the whiskey's in the cake now. And I don't know what I can say that would be more cogent than that, but I'm going to try. I guess when I was reading the book, I read the book several times, and I have to say that one of the great pleasures in life is finding a book that you can read several times, and that the more you read it, the more it unfolds in front of you. And one of the things that struck me most about this book is that it is a myth, but it's a myth that's made individual. It's a myth that's become an icon. And so the mother and the daughter feel like icons of mothers and daughters to me. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'm glad it's a myth. And if you can't hear me, will you say so? I think I love the myths, the Greek myths, of course. I love myth because it takes from what, or seems to me, from what exists, what is real, what very often what is primal, but most of all what is passionate and essential to human behavior, and gives it both its actual existing validity and something hopefully a little larger. I am bored by a lot of fiction, you know, he came into the room and or she came into the room, in which everything is what it is. As a reader and as a writer, I am always looking for something a bit more. However, Vanessa, when I sit down to write, I don't think of those things because that would silence me completely. I write a little the way a sleepwalker sleepwalks. And the myth element is, in a way, not only something I hoped to do with my own conscious, but I am lucky to come from Ireland. There are other hardships or handicaps attached to it. But I'm lucky to come from a place, and certainly in my growing up, along with everything Angelica said about the three books and the scant literature, there was a sense of ancestry. Not that people were grandiloquent about it, but there was a sense of history, of in the soil, in the fields, in the trees, in the mounds, in the forts, and all that. There was a sense to me, fueled perhaps by my over-fervid imagination, of that there was more to things than I could actually see, or than that seemed.
And it seems to, when you read the prologue, from the prologue, that seemed so clear in that it starts with this portrait of a mother and daughter, and it moves from this portrait and literally like a camera almost moving into a landscape, into the country around it. And
well, landscape is a great bonus to have. I think landscape in some fictions, I think especially of William Faulkner, when I say that, landscape is as essential to the emotional and psychic feelings of the book as the characters are. And landscape, for me, I'm very, again, I should say, grateful to have grown up in a landscape where there was so much. It was so rich in everything, in wildness, roads, ditches, walls, whereas it's much harder, I think, to write about a city and to make that city, I know writers do that, but to make that city. James Joyce is the greatest example. James Joyce, I think, no one has ever written so well about a city as Joyce has about Dublin in Ulysses. But that is rare. Descriptions of cities tend often to resemble each other, whereas in the country or in my part of the country, that's my own piece of turf.
But it's also haunted. I mean, literally it's haunted, but also, as you're saying, there's the sense of history attached to everything. So there's nothing in this book, or very little that I could see in this book, that didn't have a shadow, which sort of threw it in relief, whether it was a casual reference to a saint that, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pronounce the name correctly, but when Dilly's having her hallucination, the saint that was an unruly boy. And I looked up the saint.
The which?
The saint that was an unruly boy.
Oh, yes.
In the hallucination. And
yes.
It's a whole other story.
Yeah. Maybe the hallucination is too complicated. Not complicated.
I just felt like it was like a package, and I kept, oh, look, there's another package inside. It was grand. But
yes, well, I don't think my actual mother would really want that hallucination in written, but my mother's not alive, and I don't think I could have written The Light of Evening if my mother were alive. But having said that, I couldn't have written The Light of Evening without the energy, ghost input, hauntingness, and all these troves of letters that my mother wrote me. So she is partly the writer of the book, partly the shadow in the book, and partly maybe from up there, one of the judges of the book.
Which led me to another point, because there are There's books within this book constantly.
There is what?
Books within this book. Yes. Books, are, you read this, literally there is, because Eleanor's journal's within the book. But then Eleanor also is constantly referencing other books. And she uses books as a way to understand the world. And do you think, well, I was going to ask you if that's what you've done as well. As to start, did the books that you read, that Eleanor references in the work, Jane Eyre, Steppenwolf,
yes. Clarissa,
become a way that she is almost explaining the world to herself?
Yes, I think without books, without language, I would probably be in a lunatic asylum. I might be in one anyhow eventually, but they were and remain my great, they're more than companion, I don't know the word, they're essential to me. And in that particular story, the young woman is shut off, which is partly me, but there's a bit of imagination, I hope, as well. She's in a lonely place in the country. Her husband is a fairly Heathcliffian, brooding type, and books become her friends, and the stories of books, then she writes letters, as you know, to authors, living authors or dead authors, she writes to Scott Fitzgerald or whoever, but books for her and for me in my life are more than books. I think, and I would be very interested what anybody else thinks about this, but in the books that we love, in the great books that we love and we read, we seem to know the characters and the collision of the characters and the entanglements and the betrayals or the love or whatever more intensely and more truthfully and more spaciously than we do people we know in life. Because Flaubert, for instance, or Proust, they tell us everything. We know what Emma Bovary's garter was like. We don't know what someone we know, if they were to wear garters, what they are like. So that books were and are a great, they're more than a solace. They're a great energy for me. They're friends. They're also, I could sort of read, like Virginia Woolf said, once she said, I will sit by the fire and steep my mind in the Elizabethans. She meant Shakespeare particularly, and she meant in particular Othello she was talking of. And I find when I read those great works of Shakespeare or whoever, that I am, for a time anyhow, removed from my lesser self and from all the little things that assail me and that. But I'm also astonished. There's a wonderful word in the Bible, the wine of astonishment. Literature for me is the wine of astonishment. And there's something I'd like to say in relation to your remarking that there are many stories in this book. There's a mother's past, the mother's present, the daughter and the mother together, the daughter's marriage, the daughter's joy, and so on. And when the book was gestating, I think is the word, in me. I was in New York, and being a wayward Irish Catholic, I still go to Mass. So I would head for St. Patrick's Cathedral, because I knew the times of the Masses. It wasn't my favorite church, because their sermons are like fundraising, but I knew the times of the Mass. And all along Fifth Avenue on Sundays, they have these stalls selling a lot of different things. And just near the cathedral, there was a stall run by a Russian, a young Russian man, and he was selling Russian dolls. And they're red or blue, made of papier-mâché, I think, but very shiny, very sort of brilliant color. And you open one, and there's another doll inside, and you open that, and you keep opening, and they're giving birth. Well, to this Russian man, whose English was rather minimal, I said, oh, I have the clue for my novel. And he gave me a doll. All he wanted was to have me removed in case things got worse. So it is odd when you're writing, when I am writing, the different little things and bigger things that happen, and they all seem to be, it's a very egotistical thing, writing, it has to be. It's also a very obsessive thing. And I hope eventually it's a generous thing, but it is egotistical, of course. But there, anything that happens in the this book took me 4 years. The Country Girls took me 3 weeks. And so it's, as you see, things are getting harder in every way. And each little thing, like those dolls, all accrue to that time inside this one's own skull where nothing else seems to matter except getting a book done. It's not a normal occupation.
No, but it's so, because the other thing that made me think of was the Genesis. In Genesis, when they say in the beginning was the Word, but in the beginning of the Word here, the Word, and I guess it really is, the Word is Mother, right? But the Word starts, and I think you've trumped Genesis in this, because the Word starts with the letter.
The Word?
The Word starts with a letter.
Yeah.
And this book is so full of the letters. And it's everybody's sending letters all the time. And there's a line in the book that says, it refers to the incriminating letter. But as far as I can tell, every letter is incriminating.
Every letter contains love and a threat,
right.
I think. It's a pity, you know, talking of letters, it's a pity about letters. Now, I love getting letters handwritten, and I write by hand, and I even write the odd few letters. And it's somebody reviewing this book said, at first glance, it might seem archaic or belonging to another period because letters, I mean, there are these abbreviated text messages or something people send, but that's not the English language or indeed any other language. Letters are a way, and I'll talk about perhaps my mother's letters in a moment, but letters, again, are a way I've noticed in my life in which people, I'm thinking of nice letters now, I'm thinking of sort of loving letters, in which people are able to reveal themselves in a way they might feel a little shy or awkward about doing in life. In the aeroplane journey today, I was reading a wonderful book by Doris Kearns Goodman on Abraham Lincoln, and I was just reading a bit of it at random. And some of Lincoln's letters to his wife, Mary, when she went back to when he moved to Washington. And it was in a boarding house, and she didn't, the two children, and she was very unpopular in the boarding house. So he was quite glad to see her go. And yet the letters are very, very tender, and they're calling her back. And somehow if she was sitting there, he was not saying that. So letters have a great well of affection in them. They also have a great well of malice in them. We won't even discuss anonymous letters and so on, or chain letters, another bind around. In the case of my own case, my mother, who was very against my being a writer, I was very against the written word at all, because she felt it was the ticket really to sin and sacrilege and damnation. She really
was right in some ways.
She felt that fiction was the road to ruin, and it was as if she had read Molly Bloom's soliloquy, you know, in another incarnation. At the same time, once or twice or thrice a week, and she worked very hard. She worked all the time. Something I admire so much. She would have loved a little, you know, to be back in America, clothes or jewelry, or, well, not posh jewelry, you know, but baubles or whatever. And somehow that didn't happen. And she would sit down and write me these letters. And sometimes they were on lovely paper. If somebody gave her a present of a box of stationery, you know, those boxes with pink paper and the box has a tassel on it. And I'd get them on lovely, either ways, on lovely paper or on copybook paper. They were bulletins that were very incendiary to me, because I knew that along with the love and consideration and worry, all those obvious things, there were little daggers popping out at odd moments, accusation, then gratitude. And it was all mixed in together. And I read them hurriedly and very often would send something, a little gift, as I suppose that good old-fashioned quality called guilt. But it was after my mother died, and quite a long time after, that I actually took them out. And, you know, the hairs rose on my my head with a kind of fear. Fear, definitely. Pity. Some remorse. And sometimes some anger. All mixed in together. Because I'm one of those people who doesn't believe that something is quite so simple as I love you or I forgive you or da-da. It's all, especially with parents and especially with my particular relationship with my mother. She saw me as her savior in some way, and I saw her as my imprisoner in some way, along with all the tender things, and I would like to mention those as well. And she would knit dresses for one, you know, knit a whole dress and put a little scalloping of angora and things. She was always doing things, and it was only when I started to write, I think, that the big cut came, because by choosing to be a writer, I broke her heart. But by not, if I didn't write then, let's say I was in a kind of domestic gulag, you know, that I was forbidden, it would break my own heart, if not other parts of me. So it was a tug of war, and also a tug of love.
And it seems that in that way, and there's a lot of mirror, and Eliot said that all significant truths are private truths.
It's what?
Eliot once said that all significant truths are private truths, that the truest thing out there is the truest thing internally. And it seems that in the passage that you read where you say that, where Eleanor says, her and her mother's Hawthorns can't be Proust's Hawthorns. But she's wrong in some ways, and I think she's wrong because she's writing. I think that it almost becomes, in this book, the mother hates the writing, but I'm gonna try to break this down a little bit. It's by writing, the daughter preserves the mother. The daughter saves the mother in some way that the mother had no intention of the daughter saving her.
I hope so. I'm not sure, but it's a very nice way of thinking. Certainly, after my first six or seven books were banned, and there was a lot of annoyance, and they felt I had betrayed them. I don't think I betrayed them. I don't think one writes to betray people. One writes for some other reasons, very complex. But after things improved, so to speak, culturally in my native land, and there was a more influx of visitors and tourists and television, I used to say the two T's changed Ireland in the beginning, anyhow. This was in the late 60s and 70s. And then Ireland changed much more with the much touted phrase Celtic tiger, which now apparently has been reduced sometimes to be called Celtic kitten. So, but the actual country, in the country, things did not change, and indeed have not changed as much. And my mother became more lenient towards my writing
because the books weren't banned. They were maybe just as culpable in her secret self, but at least they weren't being banned. And then I think remission came one morning. We had a nice house, and she was lonely, the way people are. And she decided later on in life that she would keep people occasionally for bed and breakfast. I'm sure she lost money on it because, again, with her big heart, she was feeding them also. So I had a photograph taken by, it was taken actually by Lord Tony Snowden that she liked very much. And she asked me, would I get it enlarged and send it to her? So all that happened. And she had it hanging where one of these strangers from South Africa was having his breakfast. So he looked at this photograph. He couldn't avoid not look. It was there on the wall, very large. The Sacred Heart was there, and there were other things as well. And he asked my mother who that was. She said, that was me. Oh, he said, she's very well, which I think was a slight, I think this man was sent by God, perhaps, slight exaggeration on his part. He said, she's very well known in South Africa. She's as well known as De Valera. Well, De Valera being once a prime, my mother was overjoyed. She even told me that story. So what it did was to mitigate some of the shame. But you see, writing by nature is something that has to omit all relationships. In my book on Joyce, I posed the question, I can't remember if I half answered, which says, do writers have to be monsters in order to write? And I think monsters to the extent of cutting oneself off from other people in the duration or time of the writing. Joyce put it very wonderfully. He was ruthless, of course, and dedicated and everything else. But he said of himself that every day, and he wrote every day, he said he went to the far Azores, but in the evening he came back, the Azores of imagination. And I think that writing, whether it's your mother or your children or a lover or a spouse or whatever, the writer lives not out of conceit, but just by temperament and by occupation. The writer lives in the mind a great deal, and that does exclude other people. With children, it's easier, with young children, because they can barge in and out of that. But with... does that make sense?
No, it makes complete sense. I'm wondering if, though, to be a monster, because part of it is I think that the monstrousness comes out in the insistence on telling some form of truth.
On what?
On telling some form of truth.
Of truth, yes.
That becomes a monstrous gesture to another, because it could be so unsparing.
Yes, the naked, the raw words. I suppose that's one aspect of it. Maybe we lie to ourselves. I think I prefer when I'm told the truth. There's an awful lot of lies in the world around us now. The political world, the lies and the manipulation of language and of facts is so terrible. It's monstrous.
It is monstrous, and it seems to me that one of the things that's missing in the way people want to look like they think they look in the mirror. Not like they actually look in the mirror. And that there's a certain... one of the things that I love about your work is that there's something that's so human, which includes the aria, which includes the lyric, which includes the belch, which includes everything. And that is sort of the grand thing about humans. I mean, if we were gods, it would be a cheap trick.
It'd be nice to try it. I think, yes, when you talk about the aria and the symphonic side and maybe the lyrical and then the belt or the battering, I'm lucky in that, and yet I get a lot of criticism for that. I happen to be a woman and have no intention of or even a likelihood of being anything else. And sometimes from both men and women, actually, I get quite hard criticism. All criticism, I suppose, we think it's hard when it's unfavorable. And a resentment or sometimes vexedness at my being, in the words of one critic about this book, of having a wildness that somehow is not welcome in the world today, that things are more, that they're neater, or people want them to be neater. I don't court the wildness, but again, one's ancestry, upbringing, the weather, the geography, the history, the religion, the magic and the non-magic, everything that I experienced has made me the kind of writer I am. And that's something, plus being a reader, I, as is now evident, reading all the time. And I often wonder about people, including myself, where is it in us that all this vocabulary comes from? It's like something, do you know, it's like as if all these words, and then, of course, the sequencing of words. But where are the words? A child utters a few words, and there's always a bit of jealousy, whether it says mama first or dada or whatever. It says two or three things. If it sees a dog, it says dog eventually. But yet, even people who don't luxuriate or love language, in fact, have all this vocabulary. And one of the things that I am so thrilled and enthralled about is that we have language. And I would like if language was more everywhere in the big wide world. I think writing, and certainly serious literature, is to a great extent marginalized now. It's marginalized by other entertainments. There's nothing wrong with other entertainments, but the actual secludedness or concentration or whatever needed to read a book isn't as widespread as it was. And people ask me, do they mind me and my books in Ireland now? I say they don't read them. So I've gone from being banned to being not read.
No, and I have to say just that this book is marvelous in its use of, the only way I can describe it is the use of words is less like the use of paint, that there are parts where it's thick and clabbered and put in on with a knife, and then there's parts that sort of get thinner and go faster, and the story and the ideas in it are literally sculpted in this amazing language. Page 207 is one of the great pages, I think. It literally, if you just look at these two paragraphs, there's words hooked with other words that are slight variations of the words they're hooked to, so that the whole mother-daughter relationship and the way that we look at ourselves and we look at other people looking at us and try to make sense out of all of it is like this sort of beautiful sculpture that you've made.
Oh, what, I have nothing else to say. I can bask in that. Thank you, Vanessa.
And now we have questions. Oh, and a microphone and everything.
Edna, at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned that there are no real separations and no real connections.
Yes.
Very interesting concept. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, I said it sort of, I said it without thinking. Now I have to to give foundation to it. The reason is, I think, we each live to a great extent inside our souls, our minds, whatever words we want to use, our psyches. We also live in contact with people here now, but that is really only part of us. And what I think I meant was that the entire self, plus the vacillating self, plus the self that changes with experience, is never fully able to be witnessed or understood by somebody else, even if you're living with that person. For instance, it can happen in a marriage, hoping not to hurt anyone's feelings. Two people get married at roughly the same age, let us say, have the same interests in love and so on. Very often those two people change at different rates. Some develop more, some become internalized, some extra, whatever. But all along the way, a certain estrangement can happen. So that the connection, I think, being that time when one is in love, if we could remember or summon up some romantic moment, two people are very near in body and soul. And that is something very mysterious. The chemical or the element or whatever it is, the extra thing that happens to lovers who fall in love, and the love of both. It's not just pining love, as some of my characters in other books. It's actual love together, that there is a connection there. But forgive this note of, it is transitory. It has to be. Life itself is transitory. So that there is a time of connectedness. But now to talk of separation, oddly enough, separation lingers longer even in the gut. I was separated from my mother or one or two other people that I have loved. And yet that separation it's there like a gulf in one. It's never fully ended. So that I think why I said it was that. But if you have a more logical idea about it, I'd love to hear it. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about your feelings about Ireland today?
Ireland today. Well, have you been to Ireland? You have. Well, you can vouch for the fact that Dublin is a very busy, jangly city. English men getting married, what do we call it? Stag parties. They have all their stag parties in Dublin. Dublin is very lively. Some parts of the city are very prosperous. Some parts of the city are very poor. There's quite a big drug sector in Dublin. And a taxi driver was telling me when I was last there that not uncommon for him to have a passenger in his seat who is looking for money for drugs and holds a syringe to the ear to inject. So it's a jumble of many things. The cities are very different to the country. When the divorce referendum was held in Ireland some few years back, it went forward by 0.001% vote yes, and that was the voting in the cities. It was a county, city of Cork saved the day for divorce. It's a very prosperous city, country in some ways. Certainly the figures are very prosperous. And the amount of wealth in just small, you know, with a small group of people is enormous. My son, who is an architect, Sasha, went to meet some potential clients just outside Dublin a few weeks ago, and they travelled everywhere by helicopter. He went out thinking he was getting into a motor car. So there is a lot of wealth in Ireland. The country itself is still, well, you can't change landscape, that's for sure. And the landscape is still as wild and as beguiling and as wayward and as stunning, and rivers and lakes and bogs and that. They are magical. Where a big change has happened is in relation to the Catholic Church. The scandals that have been in all over the world and in this country as well, in Boston and so on, with priests sexual scandals that were, disclosed, that has actually altered quite a lot of the hold of the church on people. People are not as frightened of priests as they used to be. But they are as frightened of God as they used to be. So the church's influence is less, but the need or belief or the faith, I think, in the country anyhow, is not less. And Ireland, although it's changed and much is written about it, you don't change a place, a society doesn't change as quick as that. The money came in the last 20, 25 years, and there are, more motor cars, more farm machinery, tractors, bingo halls and things. But if you sit down and get beneath that and talk to people of what their beliefs are, what their fears are, what their wishes are, what their dreams are, it isn't that different. People sometimes say to me that I don't know Ireland because I don't live there. Well, I do go there quite a lot, and also it's a country, because it's a small country, and I don't know the population, 2 or 3 million people, it's accessible. And I'm very glad that I can go there, and that the language I grew up with, even though I learned everything through Irish in the national school, later on I learned English. The language, leaving Ireland to come to England, wasn't a terrible jolt for me as regards language. It was emotionally a cut. And going back has its... I like to go back, and yet once you leave a place... Tom Wolfe, the other writer long ago, Tom Wolfe, wrote, "You can't go home again." And I think that is true, because I wouldn't feel, to go back to that thing I mentioned earlier of being of needing to be alone and needing not to be judged, at least while I'm writing it. It's bad enough when you've written it to be judged. I think Ireland, people who visit Ireland absolutely love it. And I know why they love it, because there's a greater friendliness and there's still a greater sort of connectedness between life and nature, which you don't get in the big world. And thirdly, whether they're true or false, there still are stories.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.